This is no reflection on the quality of the human being that Randall Kowalke may or may not be. He seems like a fine man.
Walker's pick to replace Senator Dunleavy is rejected by Senate Republicans. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an outside toxicology report suggests Dallas Seavey did not drug his dogs during the Iditarod.
I was shocked, and I said, whoa. I said, look, let me get all the lab work, and let me see what I can see.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Governor Bill Walker plans to appoint a new choice to fill the vacant Senate District E position tonight. The action follows the Republican members of the state Senate voting this morning to reject Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assemblymember Randall Kowalke. Governor Bill Walker appointed Kowalke to replace Mike Dunleavy, pending the senator's confirmation. Dunleavy resigned from the District E seat in January to focus on his run for governor. In a letter to Republican leadership, the governor says members of the Republican-led Senate majority had actually encouraged Kowalke's appointment. But Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says the rejection was based on Walker not following the traditional process. That process involves appointing someone who has support from district parties.
This is no reflection on the quality of the human being that Randall Kowalke may or may not be. He seems like a fine man. The reality of it is we feel that there's a process, and we just request that the governor respect that process.
Kowalke says he was about to enter an Ash Wednesday service at church when Walker called him to tell him the news. Kowalke says he hopes that whoever joins the Senate caucuses with a Republican-led majority, Dunleavy had left the caucus.
I wanted to see us be able to work in a collaborative way to get what needed to be done for the citizens of District E specifically and for the state generally.
The district party nominated three people, Representative George Rauscher, teacher Todd Smolden, and organic food worker Tom Brond. Walker, a former Republican turned independent, said before the vote that if Senate Republicans reject Kowalke, he would forward another name. Walker spokesman Austin Baird says Walker planned to announce his second choice this evening. An attorney for four-time Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey released a toxicology report today that he says proves the musher did not drug his dogs in last year's race. Seavey has claimed innocence since the Iditarod announced in October that dogs on his team tested positive for the banned painkiller tramadol. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
The toxicologist's review says Seavey's dogs did not receive tramadol until hours after reaching the finish line in Nome. Clint Campion, a former district attorney, revealed the new information at a press conference organized by a Bay Area public relations firm. Seavey has hired both Campion and the firm to represent him. Campion says the review proves Seavey did not give the drug to the dogs and that someone else did.
He doesn't want to speculate about why someone would do that or who might have done that.
Still, some have speculated that a rival musher or someone opposed to dog mushing tried to sabotage Seavey. Seavey finished second in the race and was away from the dog yard when he says the doping occurred. The Iditarod did not penalize him for the positive tests. The race's board says they made that decision because of an ambiguous rule that has since been rewritten. But Seavey withdrew from this year's race in protest after the Iditarod named his dogs as those that had failed the tests. And now, Campion says the Iditarod should admit it made a mistake.
We'd like them to say that we mistakenly released Dallas's name, that the evidence shows that it's completely unclear or it's impossible to believe that Dallas would have done this, and we want to remove any suspicion about Dallas's involvement in drug doping.
Seavey's evidence comes in the form of the 20-page report written by Patricia Williams, an expert toxicologist who lives in Louisiana. She describes herself as a huge fan of the Iditarod. Williams says she offered to conduct the review for free after hearing what had happened.
I was shocked. And I said, whoa. I said, look, let me get all the lab work and let me see what I can see.
What Williams says she saw was a lack of understanding on the part of the Iditarod's toxicologist in how quickly dogs metabolize tramadol, as well as evidence the testing instruments were not calibrated correctly. Williams says the high levels of tramadol found in the tests indicate the drug was given well after CV arrived in Nome.
This is definitely a dosing after the trail. Every musher should be worried about this. Every sponsor should want to tighten security and make sure this never happens again.
Campion, CV's attorney, agrees that security needs to be improved and says the Iditarod should adopt anti-doping regulations more in line with the International Federation of Sled Dog Sports. That would bar the release of a musher's name if a confidential investigation finds doping rules have not been broken. Asked if CV is considering legal action in regards to the release of his name, Campion says the musher is not ruling anything out.
I mean, his goal is to move forward from this, but he hasn't taken anything off the table. As to the next steps, we're not ready to talk about that yet.
In a written statement, the Iditarod Board of Directors says it's not ready to talk about the report. The statement says the board is still reviewing the new information. But the board repeated earlier statements in a news release, saying the board never blamed CV directly for the positive drug tests. The 2018 Iditarod starts March 3rd. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a love story on the top of the world.
He does not remember meeting me.
I do too.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting February 14th and 15th starting at 9 a.m. at the North Slope Borough Assembly Chambers in Utqiagvik. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Late last year, one of the world's largest credit rating agencies announced that climate change would have an economic effect on the United States. Moody's suggested that climate risk could become credit risk for some U.S. states. Even though Alaska is warming nearly twice as fast as the rest of the U.S., its credit rating doesn't seem to be in danger. But take a closer look at some of the state's coastal communities, and that story changes. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more on what happens to Alaska's fishing towns when you add climate risk to their balance sheets.
Frank Kelty is the mayor of Unalaska. The tiny town is on an island sandwiched between the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska, near some of the richest fishing grounds in the world. Kelty has been there for 45 years, and lately he's seen a lot of changes.
We've had a huge increase in humpback whales coming right into the inner harbor by the road system, and just hundreds of them.
Kelty says people pull off of the road to watch the whale show.
They must be feeding on something. I don't know if it's krill or salmon smolt or what they are. So maybe their cycle is off, too. I don't know.
Some of the other changes in the Bering Sea aren't as entertaining.
2 years ago, we missed our herring season because the herring had already moved into the area and left when the fishery opened in July.
In Unalaska, fishing is pretty much the only game in town. And when fish don't show up, Kelty says the city starts to lose money.
And it's our only industry in this area. And the trickle-down effect you get for jobs throughout the community, be it the clinic, city workers, state of Alaska workers, it's all driven by the health and well-being of the seafood industry.
It's really not surprising that some of Alaska's communities rely on one industry to keep them afloat. The whole state has traditionally relied on oil to pay for almost everything. The state's debt manager, Devin Mitchell, says even though Alaska is at the forefront of visible effects of climate change, these things really aren't a risk to the state's credit. But the state isn't the only entity that needs a credit rating. Sometimes cities need them too. Valdez and Kodiak have them. The ratings help determine how cheaply a community can borrow money to finance things like big infrastructure projects. And in Alaska's coastal fishing communities, climate change is a very real, if not somewhat unpredictable, threat to the economy. Like, there's been this massive decline in the population of cod in the Gulf of Alaska. That's a big money fish in places like Kodiak. Mitchell says that's where he sees the most risk for communities in Alaska.
Is it just a normal cycle in the fishery, or is it something that, you know, this ocean acidification issue or warming the blob, whatever, is going to create a permanent situation? Is there an alternative fishery that might develop as a result of that, from, you know, tuna moving in or something that's a warmer water fish that the people in Kodiak are going to be able to rely on? Or is it, you know, the end of a community's economy?
This is something that fishery scientists have been trying to get a grasp on in Alaska. Beyond asking what will happen to the fish, what will happen to the fishermen and the fishing communities that rely on them? Stephen Kaspersky is an economist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says researchers are trying to model the impact on fishermen as the fleets move around to try and keep up with the fish.
And then, you know, tying that back to where do we think the economic impacts are happening, you know, for this change in fisheries landings in these given communities, you know, how much does that mean for fishery support businesses, for processors, for people who support that industry?
When I ask Mayor Kelty about economic impact, he brings up pollock. Unalaska is the top fishing port in the country, and most of that volume comes from pollock that fishermen bring in from the Bering Sea. Every year, those fishermen come to Unalaska and spend millions of dollars on fuel and groceries. That means jobs and property taxes for the city. But there's evidence that pollock are sensitive to sea temperatures. Kelty says there's this concern that with warmer water, the pollock could move farther offshore.
It's going to have a major impact to our shoreside facilities because of the distance that catcher vessels will have to run, cause a major problem for the products that we produce.
Members of Kaspersky's team have modeled the economic impacts of climate change on pollock in the Bering Sea. They're expecting a drop in pollock catch in the region throughout the next half a century, and their modeling shows economic losses that could add up to billions of dollars. But there are other factors, like if there are fewer pollock, will the price go up? What happens if fuel prices spike? Kaspersky says all of these studies have caveats. It's hard to predict what fish or fishermen are going to do in response to a changing marine ecosystem. I ask him about the mayor's concern. What about the fishing fleet moving to another port to keep up with the fish?
Is there any place in Alaska that you can look at and go, that you guys are screwed 5 years from now, so maybe you should move somewhere else?
No. I mean, nothing has come up that clear. I think, you know, I think the mayor is right. You know, these are big boats that are capable of doing that, especially in the pollock fleet. Whether or not we get more fish processing farther north, it's kind of an open question, depending on, you know, if it makes sense to open a bigger plant in Nome if the species are closer there.
In Unalaska, Kelty says it's not really a pressing concern for the city's bottom line right now.
We just did a $40 million bond for upgrades to our port facility. We were able to get the bonds, no problem. So this time, I don't think we have any problem with our credit rating.
From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
The city of Unalaska will pay $36,000 to help pay the cost of sinking a boat that's already on the ocean floor. As Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, the state moved forward with scuttling the vessel before collecting funds from Unalaska.
The Unalaska City Council has approved a funding request that will help cover the costs of removing the fishing vessel Accutan from Captain's Bay. The state scuttled the abandoned vessel last month with help from the U.S. Coast Guard, but they moved forward before collecting funds from the city. That's left councilors debating whether they should chip in at all. The final vote was almost unanimous. Councilor James Fitch was all for it.
We're obligated to pay this because the job's already been done.
The fishing vessel Accutan was abandoned in Captain's Bay in September, following a disastrous fishing season in Bristol Bay in which the ship's owner went broke, the crew went unpaid, and its 80-ton haul of salmon was declared unfit for human or animal consumption. The Coast Guard assisted the state in performing an emergency scuttle of the processor in late January. Councillor Roger Rowland was the sole objector, a position he has held for weeks. He says funding this will set an expensive precedent if other mariners decide to abandon boats near Unalaska. Plus, he says state officials hired Resolve Magone Marine to help with the scuttling before securing municipal funds.
This contract was let without any guarantee from the city. We are not obligated to pay this money.
It's unclear how much the disposal cost. The Alaska Department of Natural Resources has not responded to multiple requests for comment. Counselors are also taking steps to avoid future problems with abandoned vessels. They unanimously passed a resolution last night supporting Senate Bill 92, which would create a statewide derelict vessel prevention program and fund. Vice Mayor Dennis Robinson also expressed interest in reviewing the city's status as a potential port of refuge, the designation that brought the Accutane to Unalaska. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
A new group has begun work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to help ensure all people who work or study at UAF are treated equally. The Chancellor's Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility Task Force will study the institutional barriers that hold back women and other underrepresented groups from advancing up the ranks of faculty or administration and to propose solutions to those problems. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
UAF Associate Sociology Professor Sina Anahita says the task force that she co-chairs initially was intended to look into complaints about the disparity in salaries paid to women and their male counterparts at the university, especially those in leadership positions.
There were a group of women faculty and researchers up on West Ridge, and they experienced sex discrimination in terms of pay, in terms of prestige, in terms of the way they were treated by deans and directors and by colleagues.
Anahita says the women put together a study that showed 25 of the 28 top wage earners at UAF are men and that they're paid a total of $4.5 million. That's about nine times more than what the women earn, which is a total of about $500,000. Anahita says the six women then began circulating a petition that eventually was signed by more than 200 people, asking the chancellor to look into the situation and to request that deans undergo more sex discrimination training in hopes that that would lead to better pay for women.
So it was presented to the chancellor, it was presented to faculty senate, and people just got interested in the issue.
Anahita says Chancellor Dan White was so supportive of the proposal that he called for formation of a task force to examine the issue. And she says over the holidays, she took to heart some advice from a former student who'd earned a PhD and is now teaching elsewhere and who is deaf. Anahita says the former student suggested the task force should also address fair treatment of disabled people to ensure, among other things, that they can access public facilities. She says that's how the panel became the Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility Task Force.
It's expanded to being more broad.
Anahita says the chancellor last month appointed her and vice chancellor for student affairs Keith Champagne as task force co-chairs.
We have to demonstrate to the community, the surrounding community, and the campus community that we care about gender equity, inclusion, Title IX, and issues that impact women as students and women as employees of the university.
Champagne says he and Anahita hope the task force will be able to plug what they call leaks in the pipeline of talented women and members of other underrepresented groups who leave the university because they aren't paid fairly.
What we want to do is look at what can we do once we gather all information to work with the Board of Regents and the university to make systemic and institutionalized change.
Anahita and Champagne say their first assignment will be to review a salary survey the university commissioned in the wake of the six women's petition and to then propose how the university might pay all its women workers more equitably. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Alaska athlete Rosie Mancari's Olympics are over before they began. The U.S. ski team announced yesterday Mancari suffered injuries during a training run on Tuesday. The Anchorage-based snowboarder was training at Phoenix Snow Park, which hosts freestyle skiing and snowboarding events at the Winter Olympics in South Korea. The U.S. ski team says she injured both her left and right ankles in a training run. Mancari was taken to a local hospital, treated, and released. In a post on Instagram, Mancari revealed she ruptured both Achilles tendons. Mancari will stay in Pyeongchang and says she'll be cheering on her teammates in the coming days. Mancari was set to compete in the women's snowboard cross event, which takes place on Friday. The U.S. women's ski cross-country ski team has four more shots to make history and earn their first Olympic medal. One race Alaska skier Sadie Bjornsson has her sights set on is tonight's 10-kilometer skate race. Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell caught up with Bjornsson before she left for the Olympics and has this profile.
Sadie Bjornsson remembers the first time she felt like a star.
I was racing out of the stadium and they have these giant screens above you, and so that the spectators can watch. And I saw myself on the TV for the first time.
Bjornsson was skiing in Europe, and she says she was shocked to see herself on the big screen TV.
But the problem was I was in the race, so I was trying to focus on my race. But at the same time, I kind of just realized, like, whoa, that's me. I'm doing this. This is real. This is what I dreamed of forever as a kid.
Bjornsson grew up in Winthrop, Washington. It's a town with just 400 people. But somehow she had Olympians living on either side of her family's house. With that, Bjornsson says she started dreaming of skiing on the big stage at a young age.
You know, I was in middle school and high school and telling all my friends, I'm going to go to the 2010 Olympics. And it was kind of just like the going thing, like, okay, you're a little crazy, but okay.
She took that craziness one step further after high school and moved north to ski for the University of Alaska Anchorage. She did that for a year and then took a year off to train for the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver, but Bjornsson missed that mark. She was 21 and devastated. She says she even thought about quitting. That was until she talked to Holly Brooks.
Sadie and I are both from Washington State, and there's a big age difference between us, but Sadie has kind of been a phenom since she was born.
Brooke skied at both the 2010 and 2014 Olympics.
You know, she was like the one that grew up like beating all the boys, and everyone's like, wow, Sadie Bjornsson, you know, like she's always been good.
So good that Brooks told her to join the elite ski team at Alaska Pacific University. Brooks was skiing for APU at the time, along with fellow Olympian Keegan Randall. And she did. Bjornsson got back on track and earned a spot on the U.S. ski team, which meant financial support and better access to training sessions.
And that was kind of enough of a positive feedback that I was back on this path and I was back on the path to my dream of becoming an Olympian.
Still, that path has been anything but easy. Bjornsson has had tendonitis since she was 16. She says that just this past summer, a few different injuries had her doubting her future.
Here I am having these dreams of winning Olympic medals, and I can't even get out the door and functionally walk around.
But she got healthier, she got stronger, and this season she's done better than ever. Bjornsson already has multiple podiums in World Cup races this season. As far as the Olympics goes, Bjornsson has her sights set on the 10-kilometer skate race and the 4x5-kilometer relay.
Our women's team has been fourth place now for four championships, so we're knocking on the door of that medal, and I think it's totally possible. I think all of the girls have made one more step this summer that it's going to put us in a place to really fight for that medal.
And while they're fighting for that medal, fans in Alaska and all across the country will be cheering them on. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
The women's 10-kilometer skate race airs tonight at 9:30, and the 4x5-kilometer relay airs in Alaska at 12:30 a.m. on Saturday. And now, a love story of two people whose lives crossed at the top of the world. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this Valentine's Day report.
He does not remember meeting me.
I do, too.
Nancy and Andrew Grant met while they were working for the North Slope Borough School District back in 2002. Today, they own and run the Airport Inn in Utqiagvik, which, as you might guess, is just a few blocks from the town's runway. Neither Nancy nor Andrew grew up on the North Slope. Andrew is a self-described Army brat. His family moved around a lot. And while Nancy's father is from this region, she grew up in California. She came to Utqiagvik for the first time as an adult to attend her grandmother's funeral.
At that point in my life, I had just completed college and I had a dead-end job, but I was providing for me and my son. I was a single mom.
After connecting with family here and changing her mind a few times about whether it made sense, she decided to stay. Her husband, Andrew, traces his move back to a manager he once had, who had worked at Prudhoe Bay.
He encouraged me over a period of a year and a half to look at jobs on the slope. He said, you're a young man, you need to go to the slope, you need to, you know, get a job up there, meet your wife.
Andrew did eventually apply for a job in Utqiagvik, and got it. Just like that, he found himself moving to the northernmost town in America. As you heard at the start, there's some disagreement between Nancy and Andrew about their first meeting. But they do agree about what happened next, how they eventually became a couple. They both attended the same church and were part of a small group of single members.
I don't know, I'm just not the real hostess type, but these other ladies in the group were. So they would invite us, they would woo us with
food.
Yeah, food. Can't go wrong with food, especially up here. And games and just fellowship. And that was during the winter and spring. And come summertime, they all left, and Andrew and I were the only ones here.
While everyone else was on vacation that summer, Nancy and Andrew spent a lot of time hanging out one-on-one. Pretty soon, they fell in love. And by that winter, they were engaged. Together, they bought the Airport Inn back in 2015. It's hard to capture the sheer number and diversity of the people passing through this small Arctic town. But looking through Nancy and Andrew's guestbook is a pretty good way to do it. Tourists, Arctic researchers, oil and gas industry people, journalists. The Grants say that one of their favorite things about working in the hospitality industry here is that this place often leaves a lasting mark on the people who visit. They still get calls from one man who came up from the Florida Keys years ago and is now a fan of the high school football team.
So when we have a football game going on, sometimes he'll call the hotel and say, "Hi, this is so-and-so down from the Keys. Who's winning? What's the score?" You know, and I just thought that was the neatest thing.
Valentine's Day happens to be Nancy and Andrew Grant's 14th wedding anniversary. So, from Alaska's Energy Desk, happy anniversary. I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Casey Grove and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Zoe Sobel in Onalaska, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.